Australian.
He tests the barrier, but it stands firm. It appears that the world's largest land carnivore has met his match.
And I idolized them. I mean, they were heroes to me. But I was being sent a signal at the same time that these people do this job. And those signals were coming from all different sectors, right? Like, you know, if you want to be the president, you have to be this type of person. If you want to be, you know, a doctor, you have to be this type of person. So if you want to be a nature show host, you have to be this type of person. So I had both a dream and kind of a reality check at the same time. So I never put that dream down, but I can definitely say that for many years, I didn't necessarily have the confidence that I would get there. But I also struggled to find something else that I was as passionate about for a career. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I enjoyed other subjects. I spent a lot of time being very involved in music as a teenager. But by the time I got to college, I went to college, and on the first day of freshman year, I met with my advisor, and my advisor said, okay, well, you know, what are you thinking? What major do you want? And I said, you know what? I want to do whatever major can help me be a nature show host. My advisor, you know, was kind of stunned and was thinking like, acting or, you know, what is it? And finally landed on environmental science. And I said, great, never heard of it, but, you know, if that's what you think, I'll try it out. And it was a hit, obviously. And it was through studying environmental science in college that I learned that there is a science to what those nature show hosts were showing us, that there is a science to understanding wild animals and, you know, a science to designing the programs that can protect them, and a science to, you know, even to communicating about them. And so once I realized that there was kind of a deeper purpose there, I was truly hooked. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I can do all the stuff that a nature show host does just without the cameras, right? I can be in the wilderness. I can be, you know, collecting data on wild animals and working to protect them without a camera there documenting it. And so that's this like pivot in my origin story where I started doing that. So, you know, 20 years ago, it's September now. So 20 years ago, this September, I started college and had that conversation with my advisor and started to become an environmental scientist and ecologist. And I haven't looked back. And it's just been in recent years that being a nature show host, doing that storytelling and science communication in different forms has become possible for me. And it's definitely very, very full circle.
Did you find in your academic journey that you had to sort of resist a pull toward a more traditional academic route, or maybe a push from some people, you know, as opposed to science communication?
Yes.
Say more.
Yes. I will say that the timing of my life has been very good. There is something to say about being a millennial. So for example, you know, Instagram didn't exist when I started my PhD and came to be in the early years of my graduate school education, right? Right as I started studying bears, Instagram came on the scene, right? And I was not a kid. I was not a teenager. I was not posting anything inappropriate. I was in the wilderness with black bears. And it was that moment that I was, you know, my first Instagram posts are me, you know, with a tranquilized black bear, like taking its temperature rectally, you know, so there have been some really wonderful kind of dovetails of like how society has progressed in terms of communication at all, mm-hmm. with my science career, where it has been very authentic. So although my goal has been science communication, there have been some just great fits and great moments. And at the same time, you know, I have suffered in some ways because of my proximity to academia. I have had some jobs at institutions that were really threatened by my interest, and I'll even say my success in science communication, where I've been kind of pushed out of those institutions because we've seen things differently. And
they want you to communicate with others in the academy and not the public, maybe? I mean, is that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I've heard that from other people.
I'll say it this way. My science communication, for the most part, and you see this if anyone out there listens to my podcast, for example, it's called Going Wild with Dr. Raewyn Grant from PBS Nature. It is very intersectional. So I use myself as a vehicle to talk about my favorite thing, which is wildlife ecology. But I am a millennial Black woman. And so I don't compartmentalize parts of my identity as I tell stories of wild animals. And so because of that, when I'm talking about black bears, I might be talking about that time that I went on an expedition to, you know, the wilderness to study black bears when Trayvon Martin was shot by George Zimmerman and Black Lives Matter protests were starting, and I felt divided about where I should be. And so that has been my truth. And I've often struggled because I was educated to believe that science is truth, right? Science is figuring out what is true. And yet I have worked at scientific institutions that feel very much that there should be a separation between the person and the science. And I definitely agree with that when it comes to like data collection, right? You can't just decide like, oh, I don't feel comfortable with this data, so I'm not going to collect it. You know, nothing unethical like that, but more about the storytelling behind it. You know, the relevancy of science, I think, can be very personal, you know, can be very connected to the person. And I've worked at some institutions that have been super receptive and so, so, so supportive. And then at others that feel very traditionally. And I'll say it a different way. You know, another way is that there is a point of view that some scientists or institutions hold that science is not political. And I very much agree with that. I very much agree that science is not and should not be political. But scientists can be political. And if a scientist is Muslim or an immigrant or gay or female or anyone or Black or anyone from any kind of targeted political group, they are politicized and their science isn't necessarily, but if you support science, you have to support scientists. That comes hand in hand. You can't just support science without the people supporting the people who do the science. And so that intersectional nature the way those intersections come through in my science communication has sometimes been celebrated and sometimes been, you know, kind of deemed problematic, but I have learned so much along the way, and I have kind of unintentionally become an advocate in many spaces. I find that it works really well because I'm an environmental scientist, and so the main goal is to have a healthy, balanced, thriving planet and ecosystem. And I don't believe that can be achieved without people being well and human communities also being well, well-resourced, well-cared for, protected. So I definitely find that there is a consistency to my messaging, but it's definitely, I think, been a shocker to some communities that when I'm talking about lions or tigers or bears, I'm not necessarily just compartmentalizing the animal, but I'm bringing, you know, kind of all of existence into it.
Well, and then, yeah, that's a good entree into talking about Going Wild with Dr. Raewyn Grant, because every episode features people of color, right? Adventurers, scientists, activists. It is this blend of memoir and science. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's ever a tough sell with some of the scientists who have, I'm sure, faced the same pressures that you're talking about.
Yeah, I wonder. You know, I will say that, you know, I'm open to feedback. And I get a lot of feedback. I don't get a lot of negative feedback about the podcast, I will say, although I am open to hearing absolutely any kind of feedback.
I guess I just mean, is it a sell to get them to come on the show, knowing that they may get some of the feedback that you're getting, right? Not just, this is not just my paper at a conference where I'll be judged on the data. This is, I'm opening my whole self a little more than they maybe are used to. And as you're saying, they're maybe not encouraged to.
Yeah. You know, I'm so proud of the guests that we've had on this show because, you know, obviously it's consensual. So we give folks, you know, a big heads up.
You're not Mike Wallacing them or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a gotcha podcast. But, you know, we give folks a big heads up that we want every story to be about adventure. We want every story to be about scientific discovery or, you know, some type of journey with a wild animal or in a wild place. And we encourage our guests to weave in whatever identity statement or identity journey might parallel that wilderness journey. And it's interesting because we have had plenty of guests who are on the podcast who tell these amazing stories, put a lot of boundaries up. So, you know, I can't talk about it, but we've had a lot of guests say, like, I know you know this about me, but I'm not going to bring up this part of my identity in the story. I'm going to bring up something else. So some guests are comfortable talking about racial identity. Some are comfortable talking about sexual orientation. Some are willing to talk about, you know, religious beliefs, et cetera. And some aren't, but they are able to choose, you know, which parts of their identity they want to talk about. And so for season three, I am so proud that we've been a platform for some, you know, some notable scientists out there to talk about, you know, being gay in the 60s, you know, or being part of the LGBTIQ community and being strongly Christian through this day. You know, we talk to people who are from historically overlooked and oppressed indigenous groups in Central America. So we have, I mean, we have some major people, like high profile people, and we have some major issues, and we have all of these stories that are journeys. It's not necessarily a hard sell, but definitely know that I think all of our guests withhold a lot. So I love the way that they give and they offer. And there's definitely always parts of them that are withheld.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the PBS Nature podcast, Going Wild with Dr. Ray Wynn Grant. Season 3 premiered earlier this week. I spoke with Dr. Wynn Grant last week. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Dr. Ray Wynn Grant, a PhD ecologist who specializes in bears and is also the host of the PBS Nature podcast, Going Wild with Dr. Ray Wynn Grant. In the program, she speaks with scientists and explorers from traditionally underrepresented backgrounds about not only their work, but what they've encountered in trying to do their work. Season 3 just premiered this week, featuring the chemical biologist Dr. Rosa Vasquez Espinoza, who's done a lot of work studying very small microbes in the Amazon rainforest.
I would say one of the biggest prejudices that I have felt personally is the, oh, but, you know, you look a bit too girly girl to be going on explorations. I just don't believe you'll be going into the jungle. I just could not see it.
And as a scientist who goes on expeditions to remote places and also likes to dress up and look glam, I can totally relate to this. And it's just such a narrow view of what a scientific explorer can look like. And, you know, even when no one is saying these things out loud, I can't help but always want to prove that, no, I can do this.
I spoke with Dr. Wynn Grant last week in order to accommodate our schedules. Let us know what you think about what we've been talking about by emailing talk@21stshow.org. You know, I don't know that I've ever spoken with a scientist in the field of ecology or anything in the life sciences who doesn't talk about the way climate change or global warming is affecting what they do. But as somebody who is a science communication expert, we've had a chance to talk about this with a number of different people on our program. We had a conversation on microplastics a week or two ago in the Great Lakes. These are issues that are, they sound bad, but they're so abstract and people feel so helpless to do anything about them. I wonder if you have any thoughts on how to continue communicating these threats in a way that, you know, don't overwhelm people, but also spur them to action. You know what I mean? I guess what I'm asking you, can you help us solve climate change?
Oh, I wish. I have a guest on season 3 of Going Wild that can help us solve climate change. Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson will appear on episode 6 of the podcast. And that's the question we pose to her. We say, girl, help us figure this out. And she does. I will say the change that I've been making with my communication around climate change is to really release the burden from the individual. So we have all of us, myself included, we've all been bamboozled. We have been taught that if we use a reusable water bottle and if we put our recycling bin out and if we buy an electric car, then climate change can start to diminish or reverse. And truly, individual action is not nearly enough. It is the burning of fossil fuels at the corporate and governmental levels that is driving these problems. Huge corporations and huge government bodies are responsible for climate change, not you or me or our plastic straws. So the answer then is community efforts, right? So joining together, banding together, instead of me making my own individual decisions, all of us demanding from our corporations and from our governments that there be a change. Because if a big soda company stops selling soda in a plastic bottle, there won't be plastic bottles, right? It's not about whether or not I choose to buy the soda in the plastic bottle. It truly needs to be top down. If these big corporations decide we're no longer going to use fossil fuel energy, then there isn't going to be fossil fuel energy. It's not about which car you as an individual buy. So I'm not saying this lightly. There is so much information. I'm happy to provide resources. Again, there are experts talking about this. We are at the mercy of our governments and these corporations that control what happens next with climate change. And the power that we have is in organizing together to demand a change from above.
I think this dovetails nicely with something you talked about earlier about science isn't political. Scientists can be political. And we're also in this era where science communicators are facing political resistance, right? I think back to the pandemic. And some longtime listeners to our show might know that I used to bore people recounting episodes of the podcast This Week in Virology, which I was a fan of during the pandemic. But you know, many more people were getting their science information from Joe Rogan and the former president. What can scientists do about this?
You know, we're scared. I would say a lot of us as scientists are really concerned about how facts are used or not used, believed or not believed. The fact that so many people have kind of decided that a fact is negotiable. And it's really tricky because this wasn't as much of a major issue in the recent past. And it's, you know, there are so many crises that we would like to fight with facts, with factual information right now. So it is definitely really tricky. And I haven't necessarily come up with some distinct ways that scientists can help with this. But I will offer that I think a lot of transparency and being able to demonstrate as a scientist that our data and our facts are not partisan, can help to build some trust. And I'll give an example. I have some personal feelings about hunting, right? I will offer that I am not a hunter, and I have personal feelings about hunting. However, in my work, and let's use my work with bears as an example, often my job is to measure a bear population in a certain place, collect a lot of data to determine whether or not that bear population can withstand hunting pressures. And whether or not I agree with whether people should hunt bears or not is very different than whether or not the population can continue to grow while experiencing hunting. And so some of my work, some of my research has been given to legislative bodies that have said, okay, look, it looks like this population, if we take 4 females a year from the population and hunting, will be okay. I have my personal opinion in this area. And then I have, and I'm using my arms to gesture, which isn't great for radio, but you get the gist. So like on one side is my opinion, on the other side is the facts. And the facts do not necessarily support my opinion, but the facts are the facts, and they are trustworthy, and they were measured in a proper way, and they're going to inform a political decision. And even if I don't necessarily agree morally with the political decision, or, you know, if it doesn't match my value system, I feel confident that my science was used as a foundation in making this decision. And I hope that if more of us as scientists are able to show that our science is not biased, we may have biases within us, but our science isn't biased, people can begin to trust that science again.
The podcast is Going Wild with Dr. Ray Wynn-Grant. Our guest has been Dr. Ray Wynn-Grant. Dr. Wynn-Grant, thank you so much for speaking with us on the 21st show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.